Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
This is Marianne Sullivan.
And this week, Marianne will be speaking with Gina Song Lopez, who will tell us about her research into a hugely important topic for anyone interested in changing the world for animals, the state of veganism and animal rights in East Asia, particularly Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China. And sort of separately, if Gina and I got married, our name could be Song Singer. Or, but
I think maybe she is married. I don't know.
I am too, but you know, you details. Anyhow, so I'm excited about this interview. It's always incredible for us to just sort of put our finger on the pulse of something going on in the world of animal rights in a different location on the globe. I'm always inspired, to say the very least.
Yeah, I'm never sure how these interviews play. Is it something people are super interested in? But again, we've been doing them for a long time, trying to find people in other countries, you know, to talk about what's going on there. It's just so important to remember, because I've been doing some research of late, because I'm writing this article, like everything has changed. Everything's different than it used to be. There are substantial animal rights movements and substantial vegan movements everywhere. And, you know, that's shown in the interviews we've been doing as well. We just had someone from Nepal on. We're going to have another activist from Africa on soon. Like, everything has changed. This is now a worldwide movement. Sometimes it just feels like we're not getting anywhere. And the reason it feels like that is because we're not getting anywhere. But, you know, sometimes maybe we are. Like, it's building, and then it's going to really happen, that people are going to start not eating as much meat. So, and people are going to start paying attention to animals. It's going to happen. It's got to. There's just, it's just growing and growing and growing. And yeah. I'm trying really hard to see all of the positives this week. And wow. Certainly seeing what's going on in what Gina is going to be telling us about is one way to see all of the positives.
So we've been talking for a long time, like years and years and years, about cultivated meat as, like, you know,
it's always 2 years away
as the answer, right? And it's not really 2 years away. It's kind of here now. And I mean, it's not.
Well, it's here, but it's not in my life. I mean, it's extremely expensive in some restaurant in D.C.
Well,
I don't know.
That's okay, not, but that was how Impossible began as well. I remember trying to find the Impossible Burger, and now it's like everywhere, Burger King, you know. Anyway, my question is, I was thinking about this, and sorry to spring this on you without like putting it in the notes for what we were going to chat about today, but you just reminded me of, you know, hope and all that crap. So what I'm wondering is, were we looking to it as a, like, some kind of a North Star? Like, oh, all we have to do is get to that. And now it's here-ish. And like, oh, crap, we're still in the same muck that we were in before. Like, is it still our big hope?
Well, I think it's still a big hope, but I don't know what we were thinking before. I can't remember, but I just don't think it's the entire, I think it's a piece of the puzzle. It's a huge tool. I mean, Bruce Friedrich, of course, and the Good Food Institute, their theory of change is that and we're not there yet, because their theory of change is if it's cheaper, if it tastes just as good, and, or perhaps even better, and it's convenient, that's the ball game. Everybody will switch. And we're not there yet. So we don't know whether that's going to be true, because it does kind of taste just as good, I think. I really do. It's certainly not cheaper, and it's certainly not everywhere. Actually, though, plant-based meats are kind of, you know, everywhere. Everywhere you go, you see either Impossible or Beyond. But those are just hamburger meats, I mean, too. Like, and they're not cheaper. So I don't know whether that it's the entire ball game, because we're not there yet. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, there was a very prominent article recently, which, because you sprang this conversation on me, I don't have in front of me, but, and I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, talking about how that's not all it is. It's not just price, taste, and convenience. It's culture. And, you know, there are other things standing in the way of people changing, but we don't really know that yet, because we're not there yet on price or convenience and probably on taste for almost everything else. We're certainly not there on cultivated meat. I mean, like I said, it's just in like one really expensive restaurant in DC so far in the United States. So there's a long way to go. And it's going to be hard to get price parity or even better price reduction because of the subsidies. You know, the meat industry is hugely subsidized, and the plant-based industry or the cultivated industry ain't. There's been a few tiny subsidies that have been given to this industry, but compared to the meat industry, it's just a drop in the bucket. So I don't think the evidence is in yet, but personally, I don't think I've ever thought that it was the whole answer. I think it is a piece of the puzzle. If it was the whole answer, we could all just go home and wait for it to happen. And none of us do. So I don't think it can be. And it's certainly not the whole, you know, even if it were to take care of animals in agriculture, that would be billions and billions and billions of animals. But, you know, there's plenty of other animals being exploited. It's also waking people up to what's happening and reminding them. I don't think you even have to tell them because they all know this, reminding them that animals matter. Here's this recent analysis from Stanford University showed that from 2014 to 2020, the livestock sector received about 800 times more public funding than the alternatives sector. 800 times. I mean, like, they're just pouring our taxes into this dying industry, literally dying.
So I think I'm going to need to noodle on this a little bit and get back to you because it only, I don't know why it just occurred to me, but I think that maybe when I was speaking generalities a few minutes ago about cultivated meat, I was actually talking about myself. I think it was giving me hope that that was down the line. I think that I didn't really think about it in specifics and like, I kind of just in my vague future thought, I just was like, oh yeah, that'll happen. And then people will eat that. You know, I didn't really think about the specifics of it. And now that it's like being covered on the news a lot, you know, I keep hearing it on NPR or wherever I covered it for WXXI. I am sort of thinking, well, now what's going to give me hope? Because it's been, you know, a difficult week in some ways to just sort of, you and I were discussing our hen house a lot and just like how we want to shift what we're doing to catch up with where the world is, where the movement is, where the advocacy realm is, where our flock members are, all of the above. And that conversation couldn't happen without also looking at the state of the world as it relates to animal agriculture. And that was hard. That was really hard. I'm just being real here. So I am still hopeful in some way. I don't know why, to be honest, but mostly our guests give me hope and our flock gives me hope. But if you really were to peel that onion, I'm not really sure why I have it. And I don't want to be depressing here, which I sound like I'm being really depressing, but I need to sort of have a come to Jesus, or at least the atheist Jewish version of a come to Jesus, because I want to come up with that next North Star. Am I making sense?
Well, you are. And I think that, you know, we've always said that hope is a strategy, by which we don't mean that all you have to do is hope and that will create change. What we do mean is that unless you have to come up with some way to have hope, because that's what keeps you going. And if you don't have that North Star, some kind of North Star, some kind of vision that this could actually happen, like, what's the point? So I do think it's important to come up with something like that. I do think you're making sense. I don't think I've ever put as much hope into cultivated meat, and which is why I still think it's hugely important. We just perhaps didn't anticipate how much they were going to fight back, and they're fighting hard, and they're winning some battles, and we just have to fight harder because we're right about everything.
So this, I mentioned that we were talking about our henhouse stuff, and we happened to be doing it amidst a very beautiful and truly magical background, the one and only Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen. And it was so moving to get a tour. And of course, this is a place we've been to so many dozens and dozens, if not more, times. And this time I had a new element. I was making an an audio postcard. And I'm going to describe what that is because I realize not everyone knows what an audio postcard is, but it's something that is used frequently on the radio, like NPR. And it's basically where you're going to a particular environment and you're capturing the natural sounds as well as some of the, you know, oh my God.
All of the sounds on your recording were authentic. That was just my pig imitation.
No, you did a good job. That was good. I couldn't do that without then like coughing for 20 minutes. I don't know how you do it, but you're very good. Oh my God, Mary. Thank you for that. We didn't need to go to Farm Sanctuary for the audio postcard.
No, you really didn't.
Anyway, it didn't air yet. It's going to be airing very soon. And I'll keep you posted about that. But it's sort of like how we used to have that vegan cooking podcast, but we did it audio. And that's a challenge, right? To talk about cooking without a visual. It's also sort of a challenge, but one I was totally up for, to do to capture a tour of Farm Sanctuary, but only in audio. And so I really had a fun time. We had an incredible tour guide, Andrew, his name was, and we met some really great animals, including this duck named Pip, who loved people, but he didn't want to be touched by them. But he went up to you, and if you started talking to him, he started panting like a dog, like so much so that I included that in my first draft of the audio postcard. And I sent it to my boss and he was like, I think you're having a sound, like an audio issue, like a sound issue toward the end. And he thought that that was a sound issue because I was like, no, that was obviously a duck panting.
It was Pip.
It was Pip, clearly.
Come on.
So anyway, it was really fun. And then, oh my gosh, we did the most beautiful hike. Talk about like reinvigorating.
I can't believe in all these years of going to Farm Sanctuary and working there for a while, you never walked the gorge in Watkins Glen.
Yes, I know. I don't know what I was thinking, but, and you kept saying, you've told me 900 times how otherworldly and stunning it is. And
I don't understand why it's not famous.
I was like, Yeah. Okay. It's a hike. Uh-huh. Cute. But then we went and I was like, why didn't you tell me about this? It felt, you know what it felt like? It kind of reminded me somehow a little bit of Utah, which I think is just very beautiful and feels like you're on another planet when you're driving by those big mountains.
Yeah, like Zion.
Yeah, Zion and Bryce and all that. It sort of reminded me of that. Like if you haven't been or wherever in the world you are, just Google Watkins Glen State Park Gorge Trail, specifically the Gorge Trail. Holy crap. It's great. Anyway, I have no poignant remark to make about that, except it was very reinvigorating. I felt very alive. And I crave that sometimes because sometimes I get really weighed down by like monotony or just, you know, the rigmarole, I guess you could call
it. The unending despair and misery.
Yeah, that.
Or maybe that's me.
In any case, Gina Song Lopez is definitely someone who does not seem to get, I shouldn't make assumptions. Maybe she gets weighed down by the rigmarole, but she doesn't seem to because she's just like this incredible force of nature. And I think we should get to that interview. Gina Song Lopez is a PhD candidate at the Center for East and Southeast Asian Studies at Lund University in Sweden. Her research focuses on veganism, vegetarianism, and the plant-based movement in Taiwan and China, where a new generation of vegans and vegetarians are concerned about issues of animal protection and climate change and health and self-cultivation. Her project is also concerned with how new veganism is translated into the regional culture and political context. She will be joining Marianne right after this.
Social media has become such an important part of almost all of our lives. So please make our hen house part of that social media experience for you. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We try to post some news stories to help you keep up to date on what's happening in the world for animals. You can also find us online, of course, on our website, ourhenhouse.org, or you can email us. If you have some concerns or questions or something you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, let us know. info@ourhenhouse.org.
Welcome to our hen house, Gina.
Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. One of the reasons is because I think everybody understands that China and Taiwan and Hong Kong, which are the three areas that you study, are so important. And it's so important to understand what are the similarities amongst them and what are the similarities to advocacy in the West and to veganism in the West. And we don't understand enough about it. And that's exactly what you've been studying. And before we get into your research and those topics, you are from Taiwan, I understand. And I'd just like to hear a little bit about the current animal protection movement in Taiwan.
Yes, I am from Taiwan. Well, my dad is from Taiwan. My mom is from Chile. So I actually didn't grow up there, but I moved there. I did my master's. That's how kind of I got involved into studying the animal protection movement there. So the animal protection movement in Taiwan started around the 1990s. And since then, they had a pretty quick formation. They kind of took off from there. But mostly they have been focusing on like animal welfare, mostly. The concept of animal rights is still not so popular.
Yeah, within veganism, I mean, within the section of the movement that is interested in progressive change for all animals, is there a strong recognition between veganism and animals, or is it more focused on environmental and health concerns? Is it all three?
A little bit of everything, all three, and also a big part of it is just also connected to the religious practice. Because the original vegans in Taiwan and China and Hong Kong were probably Buddhists. Most of Buddhists might be vegetarian, but the more strict ones will be vegan, actually.
Yeah. And dairy isn't really a strong traditional food. I mean, I guess it's a very popular food now, but not a strong traditional food in that part of the world. For anyone interested in veganism or anyone who eats vegan, China and Taiwan, they represent these very interesting stories because of that history. I mean, not just because they're huge, but also we don't have any history in the West of not eating meat. It just doesn't really exist, or only relatively recent, the past couple of centuries, maybe, except for a few outliers, a few extraordinary people, but no real cultural tradition. So can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Buddhist vegetarianism started around 500 BC, before the Common Era. So basically, this emperor, Wu of Lian, he was a devout Buddhist, and he mandated that Buddhist nuns and priests should be vegetarian. Before that, vegetarianism was already practiced, and it was already associated with a certain kind of virtuous lifestyle. But it was from his reign that actually it became consolidated, this association between Buddhism and vegetarianism. And from that, this whole vegetarian cuisine developed. And until today, it's quite thriving. Actually, like all these like meat substitutes that another people is new, like vegan meat, but this vegetarian cuisine, this kind of substitute already have existed for centuries.
Yeah, and that was specifically, I mean, I assume since it's from Buddhism, that it was primarily linked to caring about animals. The health and environmental reasons really had not arisen yet so much. It was really rooted in recognizing the value of animals, right?
Yes, there was a strong element of mercy for life and definitely, yeah, caring for animals. But it depends on who you ask. There's also like an element of like self-cultivation, like, because eating meat is considered impure. Yeah, so it's a little bit of layered.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we see the same thing in vegetarianism and veganism in the West as well, that kind of personal purity as opposed to sort of a political attitude towards animals. But it's still a history. And, you know, we still have those restaurants today. If you live in any big city in the U.S., certainly, you can usually find one vegetarian Chinese restaurant that has all of those fabulous meat substitutes. So I think people are pretty familiar with it. Is there any difference between China and Taiwan on that? Or does that history go back far enough so that it's really similar?
Ooh, that's a complex question.
Oh, dear. Well, we don't want to get too far into the weeds of Chinese history. So,
Yeah. I mean, up to a point, it was like very shared, right? And then obviously there was like historical political context that things diverged. And then for a long time, I guess Buddhism thrived in Taiwan, while in China, the political context didn't allow religion to continue to develop for a while. So I think now I also like the size of both places, right? Like Taiwan is small and Buddhism, and about, I think something like 13 to 15 of the population practices vegetarianism of some sort. well, in China, there's no official figures, but some have put it at 50 million or something like that.
Yeah. Right. It's a lot of vegetarians. There sure is. Yeah. You know, I've talked to other people about this, and obviously the fact that there's this historical tradition of both caring about animals and having it affect people's consumption and the development of this whole cuisine seems like this amazing positive thing for the future. But I've also had people tell me that there are drawbacks as well, particularly in China, regarding the association of veganism with kind of something very old-fashioned and out of date and not the new thing anymore, which actually ends up being a problem. Have you also found that to be the case?
Yes, this is definitely something that when you say I'm vegetarian, most people assume that it's because of religion. And also it has a certain old-fashioned element. But that's why like the new generation of vegans, they have been more in touch with like with Western ideas of animal ethics, animal rights. And they're actually like kind of trying to infuse now the vegetarian culture with this like with this new blood and new ideas. So that's why like they're doing like amazing things. So in Taiwan, for example, the vegan fairs have become super popular in recent years, and it's all these new advocates that are trying to like change the meaning of less diets.
And do people still hold on to the whole cuisine that has been developed? Because it would be really a shame to get rid of that and just start eating Impossible Burgers because it's really good food.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, I think. So obviously in everyday vegetarian or vegan eating, you'll still go to the local Buddhist buffet. And mostly for like going out eat with friends, they will find like a more Western oriented kind of restaurant that serves Beyond Meat, or Omnipork is like this brand from Hong Kong that is like very popular over there. And some restaurant owners are advocating themselves too. And there's one in Taipei that is, she actually like incorporates all of these new meat substitutes and also like the traditional meat substitute into like traditional cuisine. So she's one of those persons that have done a lot to kind of change the meaning of eating this kind of food in Taipei. Yes.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. That I love to see them kind of blending. Getting back to the animal protection movement, we kind of talked about Taiwan, but not so much about China. What are the similarities and differences, would you say, between it's growing in Taiwan? Is it growing in China as well? And in what directions?
China is definitely more people are also becoming aware of animal welfare issues. Animal rights is a very limited topic, and I would say it can be a little bit sensitive to talk about. So even though more people are aware of it, I don't think there is anyone that could be considered an animal rights activist, because that will be a little bit problematic. Yeah.
How problematic? That it would be seen as very radical or just not fitting into the society?
It's just a very foreign idea, I think. And in the context right now, maybe it's just not the time for this kind of discussion. I mean, there's definitely people talking about animal ethics and animal welfare and doing what they can within the scope of what is allowed, right? So for example, like consumption advocacy or lifestyle kind of changes, and especially in terms of like sustainable consumption is acceptable, but maybe talking about animal rights is
just too foreign? Is it identified with the West in that way, or is it just too new? Or I wish everybody in the West cared about animal rights, but is that part of it? It seems like a foreign idea.
It's a little bit maybe too foreign, and it's just at this stage in the social and economic development, because for a long time, you know, China, for example, meat consumption, even though now everyone is looking at China for meat consumption, which is true, they're consuming more meat. Chinese cuisine in general, it has been more plant forward. So like this concept of plant forward is quite accepted. And also because of health, because eating more meat is leading to more health problems. So because of that, people are more open to this kind of discussion. But if you tell people that just recently have become affluent and can finally like start eating everything they want, or just kind of saying, why are they telling me that I cannot do this while the West have been consuming meat all this time? This kind of discussion.
Animal rights is not exactly a mainstream philosophy anywhere, but sometimes it's really important to note the differences in why, or the differences in why people think that it's not something we want to talk about. What about in universities? Are there animal studies, or do people focus on issues regarding animals, or is that also seen as a little too far out?
I know that there has been some places where there's discussion of animal ethics, but it's not very mainstream. And maybe some people might have some interest in doing some kind of research related to animals, but in general, it's seen with maybe some skepticism, or maybe if you want to advance your career in academia, people ask, why are you researching this?
It's kind of the same here. Yeah. I mean, maybe just not quite as much, but it's not really all that different. Well, it's becoming different. I mean, it is becoming more legitimized. I read an interview with you and you were talking about the weird focus in animal protection theory. That's probably a common term in academia, but it's not one I was familiar with. I really loved it. And how that relates to animal protection in, you call it the cytocultural sphere. And I'll use that because, you know, there's sensitivities about what we call Taiwan, what we call China, and what we call Hong Kong. So the cytocultural sphere, even though it's a mouthful, seemed like a good compromise to cover the group of all three of them. So can you talk a little bit about what weird is for those who are like me, unfamiliar with the term, and how it's affected the relationship to animal protection in the Sino-cultural sphere?
Yeah, so weird is a Western educated, industrialized, rich, and developed. So I just kind of usually refer to, you know, as the acronym states, it's mostly about people that, you know, in the West are educated and rich and developed. And I think most of the conversation around veganism, it's definitely like the contemporary veganism started mostly in the West, right? And so many people in the Sino cultural sphere, like students, exchange students or people that have trouble, they have come and become more acquainted with ideas of animal rights or animal welfare. And then they have taken back these concepts and maybe started their own advocacy projects. Especially like in the case of Taiwan, I know that a lot of people that began doing advocacy is because they actually can speak English, read English, and they have started translating all of these ideas into Chinese. And actually, one of the main organizations in Taiwan, the Life Conservationist Association, they translated Peter Singer's Animal Liberation in 1996 to traditional Chinese. And actually, because of this translation, a lot of people learn about concept of animal welfare and animal ethics. So, for example, the one of the main people in one of Taiwan's current main vegan animal rights organizations called Kindness to Animals, actually, he started thinking about these concepts because he read this book when he was in college. Right.
So it does feel very imported. And I think I liked what little I read about your research. I'm not that familiar with it. I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about it. Is that, and this isn't just for the Sino-cultural sphere. This is for anywhere in the world. As veganism and animal protection and animal rights are becoming international movements, you talked about them being translated. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that? Because it seems like unbelievably important that that happen.
Yes. So basically, I kind of started getting obsessed with this concept of translation because I heard a couple of activists talking about this, basically how ideas such as veganism become localized. Someone actually wrote about the concept of vernacularization. So basically, the concept of translation, I kind of mostly ended up borrowing from Sally Engel-Mary and Peggy Levitt, who talked about vernacularization. So they talk about how ideas such as women's rights are taken by local advocates and then translated to the local context, because obviously every place have their own social political context, and so certain ideas might, not only the language barrier, but certain ideas just culturally might not mesh well in the beginning. But then if you think about your own cultural practices, you can actually find ways to connect ideas that might seem foreign into something that is relatively familiar.
Yeah, and it makes total sense because animal rights is kind of, it's a new concept everywhere. I mean, even though people may have learned about it reading Peter Singer's book, it's not like when Peter Singer wrote that book, everybody in the West was like, oh, yeah, we get that. Like, you know, it's a new concept everywhere, but that it would have to be translated, I think, is a great word, not through language. I'm not using it through language, but through cultural ideas and the way people think about things. One example you gave, which I thought was so telling, and this is a very small example, and it has to do with eating habits, and it had to do with shared dishes. And this is true in the States as well. I mean, when you go into a non-Asian restaurant, everybody orders their own food and eats it. And when you go into a Chinese restaurant, you order dishes, and then everybody shares them. And that would make it very particularly wearing to be vegan, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes.
In a family that is not vegan.
Yeah, recently, actually, I know someone that is also doing some research on Chinese veganism, and they were actually kind of talking about the experience of eating the Chinese New Year meal. Basically, like Christmas, you share a table and you share dishes, and how this is a space of negotiation about veganism, and because you get so much pressure from your family to eat meat that you end up having to practice what we call like side vegetarian or something like convenience vegetarian. You just like eat the dish and take out the vegetables and avoid the meat.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess the same thing happens here. As I'm thinking of it, like in a holiday meal, that would happen, you know, a big meal in your house with your relatives and stuff, that would happen. There would be shared dishes. But it seems to be much, much more standard in Chinese culture that dishes are ordered and shared. And on the other hand, for Chinese culture, there's tofu.
Yes.
Like the most miraculous food in the world. Like, and tofu's a fairly, I mean, that's not one of these, you know, Buddhist foods, right? Tofu's a fairly accepted food.
Yeah, it's a mainstream ingredient. And actually, it's also interesting because I feel like in the West, when you order the vegetarian or vegan replacement, it comes with tofu. But in the sino-cultural sphere, a lot of the time, you actually have to maybe ask specifically for it. And then, because tofu is an ingredient in cuisine, and maybe people think of it just as an ingredient and not as a substitute. So actually, this new wave of veganism actually is also helping change how people think about tofu.
Well, I hope in a positive way, because it's just the best food on the planet. Yeah. That is interesting. Like, tofu is almost classified with meat as the things that you don't want in your meal, and you want just the vegetables, but that has to shift. I'm a little nervous about bringing this topic up, not because it's controversial, just because we could get totally lost in the weeds, and I don't want to do that. There were also language complications in discussing veganism and vegetarianism in Chinese that just blew my mind. Like, it was so complicated, which, I'm probably never going to China or Taiwan, but it's not easy to figure out what means what. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it's so complicated?
Oh, yes. In Mandarin Chinese, 素食 means vegetarian or vegan. It's like a blanket term for meatless diet, but usually it also has the connotation of being a Buddhist vegetarian or vegan. In Taiwan, at least since 2009, there has been a food labeling law for vegetarian food, and there are 5 categories of vegetarian. So lacto-vegetarian, ovo-vegetarian, ovo-lacto-vegetarian, and then you have vegan. But the vegan in Chinese does not exactly equal vegan in the West, mostly because of the allium. So for example, in China and Taiwan, if you eat garlic or onions or leeks, that's not considered vegetarian or vegan. Because of their religious connotation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very different. And I certainly wouldn't want to be ordering food that didn't have garlic or onions in it, because they're among my favorites. Let's talk a little bit about you. How did this all happen for you? How did you get involved in studying this particular issue? Did it start with caring about animals?
Yes. So I was vegetarian since I was 15 years old. And for a long time, I didn't really think it could be a research topic until I moved to Taiwan. I did my master's there. And originally, I was thinking in researching the environmental movement. But around the time, vegan advocacy started taking off. And I realized no one is talking about veganism or animal protection in general. So that's kind of how I ended up shifting towards, because it was already like in my circle and something I care about. And it was just a great opportunity.
And so you think of animal protection kind of in a very international way. How would you describe, this might be an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, your personal theory of change, like thinking about what you want to happen in the world, and your work, all of your research is focused on these changes and how they're occurring. So how do you think about how we can get from where we are, which is completely disastrous, to where you would like to be?
Oh, I think maybe we live in a time right now that a lot of people feel maybe very pessimistic. And then even though they care about something and they're feeling, what is the point after reading the news? But I think you need to, very cliche, you need to be the change you want to see in the world. So even though it might seem hopeless, if you're doing something, at least you know that you're part of the solution, right? Even though it might, in the end, the results might not be what you want, but at least you know that you're doing your best.
What is the China Vegan Society? You mentioned that in this article that I wrote. I mean, that I read.
Oh, yeah. So the China Vegan Society is, as the name says, is a Chinese vegan group. They're promoting veganism. largely in relation to sustainable living lifestyle kind of agenda, but they also have held some talks in terms of animal welfare. They're trying to provide support to local vegans. And also they recently came up with a food labeling, like the vegan label for China, because before they don't have such a thing. So recently they came up with this food label that businesses can apply to, and then people can like safely buy these products and know that it's vegan.
And would you say that it's having an influence? I mean, you said before there were 50 million vegans and vegetarians in China, which, I mean, that's a huge, huge number, but is it enough to make a real difference in a country that has so many more than 50 million people?
I mean, the numbers are not official. No one exactly knows how many there are, but...
Yeah, I understand. It's a guess. Yeah.
And it's for the people that are already in the vegetarian or vegan. It's definitely making a difference for them. And also the new generation, my younger generation, like Gen Z, there has recently been some studies about they're actually more flexitarian. So they're more food conscious and more like ethically conscious. So I think we need to observe more closely what the younger generation will be consuming.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the same here. I mean, that's my impression anyway. Those are the attitudes towards veganism. What about the attitudes towards animals? Do you also see a shift there that people are more, well, you know, both that people are more conscious or that more people are conscious that animals matter, and also whether that translates into behavior change?
It's complicated, but I think that as people, especially as people are now starting to have pets, they have the kind of human-animal relations are changing, and pets are becoming part of the family and they're becoming more aware of like, this is a sentient being, right? So there's definitely like a shift in views on certain kind of animals. But then again, farm animals are like out of sight, out of mind, and just people don't think about it. So there's like obviously some change in some aspects in terms of views of animal. And then there's other parts that are not, that are quite disheartening. So
is there awareness of the growing factory farming and the harms that that might cause, or are people as blind to it as they are here?
I think that there is more awareness of issues around factory farming, but more in terms of food safety. And I mean, animal welfare, when it's equated to better quality of meat or like safer meat, it's like there's such kind of awareness, but not so much in terms of actual ethical don't eat lives kind of awareness.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the saddest developments of really relatively recently, I would say the past 20 years, is the huge growth of dairy in the sino-cultural sphere. Can you talk a little bit about that and how prominent it's become in countries where there are a large number of lactose intolerant people? It's just so crazy.
Definitely there's like milk. Well, consuming milk is seen as, you know, healthy and helping people grow, becoming taller. So yeah, there's definitely a strong push towards consuming more dairy. Well, actually, it's such an interesting development because like in the past, dairy was associated with one kind of the frontier, like the borderlands and what they thought as the not so civilized groups. And then, and also with foreigners, when like with colonization, like foreigners brought like this meat and milk consumption. And then suddenly there was a shift around maybe 100 years ago or a little bit more than that consuming milk is good and healthy.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but it was originally associated like maybe with Mongolia or those parts of the world and seen as like not appropriately Chinese, looked down upon.
Yes.
Interesting. That's so interesting and really sad. I mean, it's nice that people don't look down on Mongolia anymore, but it's really a shame they started drinking all this milk. It's just a tragedy. So tell us about the next steps in your own research. Your own research is so interesting. I don't know whether I asked you enough about it. We did touch on it, but tell us a little bit about what you're trying to establish in your research and where it's headed right now.
So my research is about the plant-based food / vegan advocacy in Taiwan and China. And basically what I'm trying to do is kind of give an account of veganism from our perspective and like how these concepts of animal ethics and sustainable living, it's actually been translated into local practices, like how the people that are advocates or promoters or part of businesses are taking these concepts and trying to move forward towards a more, let's say, plant forward future or more vegan friendly future that is also good for animals.
though your research is in that part of the world, this is really important to be done everywhere, isn't it? That we can't just impose Western veganism on the world. I mean, not only should we not, but it's obviously impossible. It has to be, as you say, translated.
We'll definitely need to pay more attention to the work of local advocates and translators. Yes.
Well, it's really important work, and I'm really glad you're doing it. And thank you so much for sharing it with us today. I think people will find this really interesting. And can you just remind people where they can find you on social media?
Oh, yes. I'm on Twitter. You can look at Abeti Academy, or also on Instagram.
Great. Thank you so much, Gina.
Thank you for having me.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more our hen house will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review.
Anxiety's rising. Our first story today is a doozy. This was reported on by Kenny Torella at Vox, and it is about the anxieties rising within the meat industry, specifically Tyson, and within the USDA, about the climate problems associated with beef, or dead cows, as I like to call it. Climate-friendly beef could land in a meat aisle near you. Don't fall for it. And this is this new thing from Tyson. And as Kenny points out, every few months, like clockwork, environmental scientists publish a new report on how we can't limit planetary warming if people in rich countries don't eat fewer cows and other animals. But let's face it. I mean, I would be thrilled if chickens were as climate unfriendly as cows, but they're not. Cows are huge. According to this article, cows account for 10% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. Unbelievable. Poor cows. Anyway, so Tyson has this new product. I don't even associate Tyson with beef, but I guess, you know, that's one of the many animals they torture. Tyson claims that its new climate smart beef program, which will be supported by taxpayer dollars, of course, has managed to cut 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions from a tiny fraction of its cattle herd. Now, like, there are two 10%s here. They're different 10%s. Cows are responsible for 10% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. And what Tyson has done for this very, very specific group of cows, they've cut 10% of what those cows emit. So it's like, you know, like, we're not talking about a huge reduction. But still, these are the ones that they're touting. And USDA has approved a climate-friendly label. Tyson says things like, if we're showing up for the climate, then we've got to show our work. Yet, as Kenny points out, that work is nowhere to be found. They declined an interview for this article. The USDA responded to a request for Tyson's environmental accounting model, by which, you know, the USDA is issuing this label, said they'd need to submit a Freedom of Information Act request. That's like, you know, it's not exactly a black hole, because FOIA is an important law and people do find out things, but it ain't easy. Like, they're putting this label on and they won't tell anybody why. Unbelievable. Apparently, the Nature Conservancy and the Environmental Defense Fund are also touted as having been supportive of this, but they also both declined interview requests. But they did supply some information which indicated that, you know, that they really didn't have a whole lot to do with it. I'm sure they don't want to associate themselves with it, but they probably, you know, get some funding. Who knows? Tyson's website does mention that grain farmers who supply feed to its cows employ practices like planting cover crops and reduce tillage. And these are apparently good practices agriculturally. They're good for soil health, but they haven't been shown to have anything to do with cutting emissions. They also talk about nutrient management, which is great, you know, reducing the use of fertilizer, but nothing on emission saving. It's insane. And they get to put the words climate friendly on their beef. As this article points out, what Tyson's done here is equivalent to making a Hummer 10% more fuel efficient and calling it climate friendly. This is greenwashing to an extreme extent. And the problem is that people, you know how people are, they don't know anything and they're eager to think that anything that what makes them happy and makes them able to continue eating what they eat is good. And they don't look deep. How could they? This, you know, this is all so complicated. So according to this article, Vox polled consumers about which parts of the food sector they think contribute most to climate change. Meat and dairy production came in dead last, even though it's the top contributor in the list. And they're not comparing to other foods, but to other types of things in the food sector that cause climate change. They think it's all about pollution and plastic food packaging and transporting. But you know, meat and dairy production, they list it last of all of these things. And it's actually, is it first? Yeah, first. It should be first. People don't know. And now they're being lied to so that they don't find out. Unbelievable. I say that every week. Unbelievable. And yet, I know we all believe it. The next article is really crazy. This is from What Agnet. Is animal fat the next big thing in dieting? I swear to God. I swear to God. That's what this says. It's a weird little article. It has this picture of a bottle of apparently liquefied chicken fat. I don't know. Animal fats may be the next big thing in dieting. Can the chicken industry cash in on the trend? And what this guy is talking about, this guy being one Austin Alonso, is that a lot of social media influencers, you know, which I wouldn't know about because I'm pathetic about social media, people are really down on seed oils. Now, of course, you don't have to use oil at all. And you can use olive oil if you don't want to use seed oil. But the chicken industry apparently might have, you know, an in here. Because social media trends, celebrities, and Joe Rogan move the needle with consumers, interest has peaked, especially if viewed from an animal agriculture perspective. Rhetorically, the argument makes some sense. Yeah, rhetorically, maybe it does. In actual factual reality, it doesn't. You know, they say that people didn't used to eat seed oils or seeds. They used to eat animals. You know, it's kind of a paleo mentality. Even the article is not particularly, is pretty skeptical about the validity of that and points out that the truth of these arguments is hazy. Historically, seed oils are not new to cooking or chemistry, with a history stretching to antiquity around the world. And dietitians observing the topic from a nutritional angle agree eating lots of high-fat processed foods or foods fried in any kind of oil is not the best decision and don't seem to think that seed oils are the worst. But there's money to be made here. And, you know, if shoppers make up their mind that soy makes them feminine or that hateful seed oils are toxic, then the market should respond with products to fit their needs. I mean, I don't think he's talking about needs here. I think he's basically conceded that he's talking about something that's deceptive. The chicken fat is certainly available. They've got a lot of it. They're killing a lot of those birds. And there's likely a way to collect the most sought-after oils from the organic, vegetable-fed, etc. birds. Those will make you healthy, right? Integrators could market this to specific consumers looking to follow a trend, or maybe to niche food service customers interested in capitalizing a trend and using animal fat to differentiate their product. I swear, if this happened, I just give up. If they can actually make it popular to eat animal fat, in spite of the unbelievable amount of evidence that it'll kill you, I just don't know. All right. Our next article is from Hordes Dairy Man. And this is a horrible article. I'm sorry. Where can we cut when milk prices are low? I bet you can already guess where they can cut. With low milk prices and rising costs for inputs, the milk prices are low because nobody wants your crappy product. 2023 is not shaping up to be a profitable year for dairy farmers. They always say that, but you know, they never seem to go out of business. And so where are we going to save money? That's the question. One of the ways is feed. Our fresh cows need all the goodies to make milk. Once cows are in the back half of their lactation, there might be some additives that can be removed, or there might be byproducts available locally that could lessen the ration costs. And I didn't even know but what the difference between fresh cows and cows in the back half of their lactation. But I think we could all imagine, you know, the ones who are starting lactation are probably much more productive. And so you got to be nice to them. But as soon as they, you know, production goes down, yeah, feed them garbage. What do we care? Later lactation is the place to look for cutting costs. We don't want to jeopardize the peak of the cows. And it's also a good time to review herd records. The cull market price is good right now. Evaluate the cows that are making milk. Maybe ones that are less profitable could be more profitable somewhere else, i.e. in the slaughterhouse. Like they can't even tell the truth to each other. Oh, disgusting. They also talked on stocking density, that some farms are keeping more cows in their barns than they should. And keeping too many cows crowded means you're hanging on to lower end cows. And you don't want to sacrifice cow comfort and cow health by overstocking. But overstocking might work better for late lactation cows. Again, the ones who aren't as productive. Who cares about their comfort and their health? We absolutely don't want to crowd fresh cows. That's not that easy to say. We know that's going to affect production real fast. Heifers, you know, these are the young cows who haven't yet given birth. Heifers are cash flow drains. Some farms should not be keeping extra heifers around, especially if they're buying feed for them. It's craziness, buying feed for them. And if they have to be treated for illness, they're not likely to reach their full potential. You know, these are animals that may best be culled from the herd. Again, they can't use killed. They have to use culled. It's their clever act. Their clever word for to substitute for killed is they call it culled. Lastly, and here's the nice part, the group emphasized the importance of taking care of yourself, your family, and your employees during challenging times. If we're not taking care of ourselves, we can't take care of our animals, which, as we've just seen, they're really, really eager to do as long as they're giving a lot of milk. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for our show. As always, if you enjoy the podcast and you're able, we would be thrilled to have you join the flock by going to ourhenhouse.org/donate and signing up for $10 a month or $100 a year. Or you are welcome to make any size donation that feels comfortable to you. You can also support us by leaving a glowing review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Like us on Facebook, where you can also leave a fabulous review, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Our Hen House. Join our online community at ourhenhouse.mn.co and spread the word about the podcast to friends and family. The Mighty Networks platform, which again is at ourhenhouse.mn.co, is available to everyone, regardless of whether or not you're a flock member, though we do have a lot of robust information behind the paywall of the flock section, so do consider that when you're considering joining the flock. And if you already support us, thank you so much. Remember, if you become a flock member, you also get bonus content each week, an opportunity to have a one-on-one session with me, Jasmine. And you also get access to that aforementioned fabulous flock bonus area of Mighty Networks. If you donate $250 or more, we'll also send you a pretty fantastic Our Hen House brass pin. So thank you so much to those of you who support us. Thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan, to Vicky Beechler for her work in producing this podcast, to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Eric Montgomery of the Podcast Haven for his work editing the podcast, to our production assistant, Jocelyn Martinez, and to Veronica Kalinska, who designed our logo and other graphics. I'm Jasmine Singer, and I'll talk to you next week.